Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services there on the web at .foil.com. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Stuart Ashman. He's New Mexico's Cultural Affairs Secretary, and we're going to be hearing from poet Gabe Gomez, who has a new book of poetry out. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Hutchison. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and we're here the first Wednesday of every month, except for this month, which is the second Wednesday, but close enough. And we're also delighted to be joined by Dr. Richard Patton. He's an animal nutritionist, and he's going to be giving a lecture tonight on this very subject of animal nutrition at 6 o'clock at 2720 Camino Entrada. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
You know how sometimes we have people on and you chit-chat before the show and sometimes you don't? This has been one of those mornings where I didn't even want to go on the air because it has been incredibly fascinating already, and we haven't even talked to Santa Fe yet.
We hope to bring that chit-chat to the people, Bill, as opposed to just hoarding it for ourselves.
It belongs to everybody, even though I secretly want it all for myself.
So animal nutrition, I mean, this is a huge subject, and you're not just focused in your work on dogs and cats and birds and pets. You're really looking at the whole scope of zoo animals, wild animals, livestock, and pets?
Yeah, correct, Mary Charlotte. The common denominator for me has been animal nutrition. So it's been all animals everywhere.
Well, let's start with everybody's favorite animal, dogs.
This is an ongoing point of contention between Mary Charlotte and the cat lovers of Santa Fe.
We do get some letters from cat people, and we understand that cats are people too. But let's start with dogs. What did and do the ancestors of dogs and the relatives of dogs eat out in nature?
The answer to this is what I call the primordial diet. And if you were to just leave here and go subsist on what the world had to offer in the way of food, you would get a good picture then of what we've all evolved to eat. This primordial diet has just about everything we need without exception. And if you were to provide this to your pet today, you'd find that you had a pretty healthy animal. The problem is when we get into the disconnect of what is available in the grocery store, so to speak, and what is really needed.
Well, what is in this primordial diet? Primordial dog diet, specifically, or wolf diet, coyote diet?
Yes. Years ago, it was my assignment to make a diet for crocodiles. And as we researched, well, what do they eat normally, we found out it was a function of their body length. When they were tiny, they ate insects. When they were 3-4 feet, they ate birds and small mammals. And then when they were 15 feet, they ate big mammals. And so you said to yourself, well, what does this tell us about what they eat? Well, when you look at the analysis of all those different creatures, it's the same. It tends to be about 20% protein, 20% fat, and about 4%, 2-4% carbohydrate.
Not a lot of carbos.
So this is the
problem. Crocodiles eat the Atkins, or the dogs eat the Atkins diet.
The crocodiles were first. Atkins came along later, but he had it right.
Crocodiles eat Atkins himself.
The predominant failing of our approach to nutrition, both for ourselves as well as our pets, is excess soluble carbohydrate.
So what are we doing in the way that we feed our animals? What are we doing right now, and what are we doing wrong?
A lot of people rush to condemn the pet food industry as, the perpetual source of malnutrition. And I think that this is uncalled for. We must keep in mind what all they do right and well. I believe that if you've bought a pet food from a reputable company, your pet is being pretty well fed. I feel that the dry diets provide too much soluble carbohydrate. So to the extent that you can lean this back with things that are low in carbohydrate, the more you do that, the better.
So what, for example, do you have a dog? What do you feed your dog?
He nodded his head yes there. Well, you must recognize that in my house I'm not in charge of animal nutrition. In Europe, they pay me lots of money to tell them how to feed their dogs, but in my house I'm not in charge. But my wife decides these things. And
she doesn't listen to you, the animal nutritionist?
Of course not. You're never a prophet in your own land.
This is highly demoralizing. Go ahead.
So it's largely the approach that I espouse here. It's dry dog food cut back with freeze-dried and fresh and canned.
One of the things we were talking about before we came on the air, which we were talking about my big dog who's older and who's been limping a little bit. She has some joint problems. And the question of animal nutrition is, as Rich said before we went on the air, really kind of the question of the longevity of your animal. And it's so interesting to, for me at least as a dog owner, to think about this now when she's, 10 years old and, for a large breed dog, that's pretty old. And all the things, I mean, let's not get into the regret of what could have been, but all the things you can do from day one to keep them healthy and to keep them living longer. And certainly, as my body begins its inevitable decline, as it hurts a little bit more to stand up.
Grease sled to hell, we call it.
Yeah, exactly. Then I really get more and more the importance of not just animal nutrition. Well, yes, animal nutrition in the sense that Homo sapiens are an animal as well, and how desperately important that is for us to be able to just keep plugging along. And
well, what are these things? What are the things that we should, let's say you get a puppy or let's say you get a kitten, what should we do to see to it that they will have not only a healthy life, but that the infirmities of old age will be
minimized
a little bit better?
It's a very good question, I feel, because the answer, first and foremost, is behavior, both the pet owner and the pet.
More so than nutrition?
They're inseparable. You can't have proper nutrition without some control on your behavior. You can't indulge your pet with overnutrition.
You mean if they ask you for food and you don't give it to them? You shouldn't give them it to it every time they beg?
No, that would be a good start. The thing is, it doesn't matter what species you're talking about. If it's the lowly roundworm all the way to the human, it's been demonstrated time and time again scientifically that if you reduce calories, they live longer.
Very interesting. So if you don't let them chub out, basically.
The best diet is exercise.
I remember reading a few years ago about, and I can't remember the word, but it's an Asian idea of diet that translates basically to 80%, that you eat until you're 80% full, you sleep until you're 80% rested, you exercise until you're 80% exhausted, and that this is what extends your life, that you don't overindulge in anything, but you certainly don't underindulge in proper nutrition and exercise and sleep, etc.
We have our genome and every other mammal's genome is perfected to deal with lack.
Very interesting.
We have no ability to deal with excess. Hmm. And that's why the constant excess soluble carbohydrate makes for a shorter life. So if you will bring some behavior modification to the issue, some self-discipline on feeding your pet, and you keep the pet exercised and slightly hungry most of the time, this pet's going to live a long, healthy life.
And let's talk about meat. I mean, there's meat and there's carbohydrates, but there's also vegetables. Are dogs carnivores or omnivores? And what about cats? It seems like a dog is a lot more likely to eat a lettuce leaf, at least judging from my household, than a cat.
That's several questions. First of all, the dog is an omnivore. The cat is a carnivore. The dog can and will subsist on a wide array of things. The cat must have a higher protein diet.
So what are the non-meat things that you should feed your dog?
I will chime in very quickly. I'm not the animal nutritionist here, but certainly I do little experiments when I'm cooking at home, And along with my big dog, I have a little pug, and the pug is an absolute vegetable hound. He will eat any vegetable that's put in front of him without exception. He'll chow down on tomatoes and mushrooms and celery, and I used to give him onions until I got a stern warning about that. Is that unusual? The big dog won't go for the veggies, and I'm never sure how much, if I should limit his veggie intake or maybe even replace some of his diet with fresh vegetables, mostly because I don't know, because I've never had a dog that would consume vegetables like such a little pig before.
Yeah, I mean, my dog Milk does the same thing, whereas Honey won't touch a lettuce leaf.
Let's come at this from a couple of directions. First of all, there's a huge variation in taste and behavior, and it may have nothing to do with an innate intelligence about what's good for you and what's needed. if you become a student of animal feces, which is part of my profession, you observe...
I think most pet owners are inadvertently students of animal feces, unfortunately.
You observe the coyote dung. It contains mouse skeletons, it contains apple core, it contains hair, and in the fall of the year, lots of juniper berries. And so what the omnivore needs is a little of everything. Now, to come back and answer your question, Mary Charlotte, about what protein works for the dog versus the cat, this is answered, first of all, by considering the fact that when you talk protein, you really must talk two things, amount of protein and quality of protein. So the best protein there is egg. And so you can have a dog diet that is 10% protein from egg, and it will be a better nutrition than a dog diet that is 35% protein from shoe leather. So you cannot talk about just the amount of protein. You must talk about its quality as well.
How important is variety? And I ask this because I had my little dog, Honey, she was almost obese. And I put her on a special diet that involved cooking ground meat and brown rice. And that, combined with exercise, slimmed her right down to where she's a normal dog. And so that's what I now give the dogs. Same meal every day. Some of that ground meat mixture with kibbles. But then I'm thinking, maybe I should change it up. I mean, did they need a variety? Certainly we evolved to eat a variety of foods, we and the dogs.
This is an area of debate right now among scientists and researchers. Do you need a constant variety? I think that what we turn to here is the animal for the answer. I mean, if you have a shiny coat and a healthy animal, then your diet is just fine.
Even if it's the same 365 days a year.
Exactly. I mean, within a year or two, if there's a deficiency of almost anything, it's going to show up.
What are the signs to look for when your dog doesn't have proper nutrition?
Obviously, excess. Weight loss is the first thing, but the other thing is it's a common denominator. The first thing to go is hair coat. It's hair coat is particularly fragile in cats. The first thing to go and the hardest thing to repair.
We see that a lot at the shelter. Even the most untrained eye can see when a dog or a cat comes in on the first day. Their health just by looking at that coat. If you see that dry coat, lots of skin flakes, and it just looks, it's the difference between an animal that looks healthy and an animal that doesn't look healthy from the get-go. And it's interesting, I hear what you're saying about changing over time, but we often don't have the animals for months and months and months. They go into a home, ideally where they get a good diet. But even in a couple of weeks sometimes, we see, in giving them a good diet and paying attention to their nutrition and not giving them crappy food, we often can see a small change, or at least a recognizable change, sometimes within 2 or 3 weeks. And it's, I suspect part of that may be a level of care also that is not having the animal as stressed out as perhaps it was on the street. But it's been stunning to see that even just along with the body, but the psychological improvement of an animal who's eating healthy.
Absolutely. What you're touching on is, to me, one of the most eloquent and inspiring things in all of biology, and that's our ability to deal with lack. Years ago, my wife Elaine and I took a Doberman from the shelter for recuperation. He was rescued by animal control, weighing 35 pounds as an adult. And He, of course, looked like a victim of Auschwitz, and he recovered fully. And he lived with us for over 10 years.
Wow.
A completely healthy life. This is highlighting his dramatic ability to deal with lack and to wait till times get better and recover at that time. What the evolution has perfected in all of us, people as well as pets, is this ability to deal with lack, temporary lack, to get through the moment for when things are better later. What we have no ability for is to deal with constant excess. It's the analogy might be we evolved to deal with to live with gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the laws of gravity are suspended.
We got nothing keeping us tied to the earth.
We've no way of relating to it. And this is what we've done to our pets with excess soluble carbohydrates. Is up until the advent of agriculture 10,000 years ago, there really wasn't any source of soluble carbohydrate.
Soluble carbohydrates, just so we know, we're not just talking about sugar.
Starch as well.
Starch as well, and that's starch from white bread and so on. But what about more of the rough grains and whole grains? Are those soluble?
There's a little soluble carbohydrate in many things, but the operative word there is a little. We must have a certain level of blood sugar, and soluble carbohydrate helps maintain that. But it's when you get excess.
So what about giving pets people food?
I'll answer that this way. If the people diet is healthy and balanced, and the pet gets a cross-the-board 10% of it, perfect diet for the dog. The cat's a carnivore. The cat needs a little more protein.
One of the things that was interesting, one of our veterinarians a few years ago at the shelter said to me, I took a cat home who was enormous. He was about 22 pounds when I took him home.
That's terrifying.
He was really overweight, and he put on another 2 pounds before I really went after his diet. Now he's down to a healthy 16.1. But one of the things that our veterinarian told me was that cats who are living on the street, who are stray cats, will revert to this sort of ancient way of getting calories, which is when you are presented with calories, you will consume all the calories that are available in that moment because God only knows when calories will be available again. And it's interesting because I could see in a way how that trains this cat who is now the same. I mean, I have to monitor his diet very closely or he'll put the pounds back on. That it's almost exactly like what you're talking about. In the wild, maybe you'll get some food today, and then you won't get any food for two more days. And I can see how this that reverting back to that can cause problems, especially for a cat who needs that protein, that meat protein.
Well, what your veterinarian friend is alluding to in the literature is called the concept of the thrifty gene. And it's often cited, for example, with the Pima Indians all having diabetes since they've encountered their society collided with contemporary America. I think that this is there is a thrifty gene, but it's in everyone, in everything, including this feral cat. So what you really have to watch for is... certain individuals, for example, a feral cat raised fighting for itself on the street, so to speak, never gets over this behavior. And it always pigs out on whatever it's presented. But then there's others that were raised in the same circumstances that adapt nicely to occasional feeding. So it's more an individual behavior thing than it is a particular biological imperative.
Well, I mean, probably everybody knows there are some animals, some pets who self-regulate and some who don't. In my household, I have one dog who will eat until she dies if you gave her an infinite amount of food, and the other one will stop when he's finished.
This is a good point. There is a vast array of behavior differences. We had a dog that wouldn't go through an open door without looking at you for permission.
Yeah.
Wow.
And at the same time, I had a bloodhound one time who, if he was starving to death and you had 5 pounds of raw meat and called him, he might think about coming to you. So there's these wide ranges of difference in personalities in your pets, and it's incumbent upon us to read these correctly.
Well, I think you're making an important point, which goes far beyond animal nutrition, which is just as Homo sapiens vary widely in their taste and proclivities, so do animals, even animals of the same breed. I mean, two golden retrievers or two Jack Russell Terriers aren't going to be the same in what they want to eat and how they behave.
That's interesting. That harkens back to what you said at the beginning, that the question of animal nutrition is really a question of behavior, and that question of behavior, I think, means the individual's behavior as well, me as an individual and my animal as an individual. Because certainly, with the two cats and the two dogs in our house, all four of them are incredibly different eaters, and they're, you know, of course, they're very different. Each one of them is a very different person, but the way each of the two dogs and the two cats eat, their whole interaction with food is vastly different one from the other.
I believe, Bill, that you're... bringing up the issue of behavior is indispensable to understanding the problem. I remember one time at a zoo in Colorado, all of the primates had hair coat problems. And they were in what in the 1950s was a state-of-the-art enclosure. But it was, of course, very outdated, very sterile, a lot of tile and glass. Every primate in the collection had a hair coat problem. And I tried every move I could think of to fix this. Nothing really worked. One day a keeper, quite by chance, scattered peanuts all over the floor of these exhibits that had lots of hay. And every primate spent many hours every day looking for peanuts. Hair coats all got better right
away. Wow.
What we don't fully appreciate is how by our just being people and living in our world the way we want, we alter the behavior of all our pets in ways that impact and echo forward and that we rarely pick up completely.
I think about this a lot when I look at my pug who came from the shelter. You know, no dog should look like a pug looks. I mean, I love this little dog with all my heart, but...
You don't think it's highly adaptive?
It's a travesty that I feel like it's a travesty that we as humans have done have basically made an ornamental animal. I mean, the pug is not a bloodhound. It's not a retriever. It's not. We're going to get letters on this one. It's not useful in any kind of practical way, other than that, you know, he's
what
a
do you
heartwarming
mean?
Little creature.
Love is useful.
But I see that we. This is absolutely the case. He would not have the issues he had if it weren't for the human interruption and the human interaction, which makes me think of another question. I have a friend who has gone to a completely raw vegan diet, and I hear this a lot with people who cook for their animals, who make their animals food, the argument between making a raw diet for your animal and making a cooked diet for your animal. And I used to cook for my big dog. I haven't in years, but... Is raw diets for animals, for domestic animals, better than a cooked, or is cooked better, or is there an answer to that question?
It's a loaded question that you ask, because no matter how one answers it, you alienate some and you enthuse others. Let me begin by saying I remember...
But the truth will set us free no matter what the answer is.
Well, first it makes you miserable. Let me answer that question this way. I worked for years for a very large and well-respected dairy facility in Southern California, and they had a portion of their milk that was sold as raw. And there were individuals that swore their life and their health was greatly improved by raw milk. But for the most of us, pasteurized milk is enough, and even for many, no milk at all. So you must be careful when you say everything must be raw. I believe it may be true that for you as an individual or your pet, that there may be a distinct benefit to raw. But I don't think it's true to say that everything must eat everything raw. Now, I have clients that manufacture raw food, and they make some pretty interesting claims that they can substantiate for this raw. And I believe that raw is better. But I don't think it's better enough for enough individuals that everybody should be doing it.
Well, I suppose you could do a test with your animal. You'd put a plate with a piece of raw hamburger and a piece of cooked hamburger in front of them and see which one they eat first.
I think my dog's head would explode trying to figure out how come she couldn't eat both of them at the same time.
Well, listen, here's another question which I think is important. Do animals have instincts for what herbs to eat when they're sick? I mean, the nature provides an abundance of healing herbs, which human beings have discovered. What about animals?
My personal opinion is that this ability exists in all creatures to one extent or another. I believe in people it's been largely reduced to sodium. In our ability to detect, to be driven to consume what's missing is pretty well lost. I think if you look carefully, if you've had a huge amount of popcorn for the past 3 days, then you're full of sodium and everything tastes very salty and you avoid salty things. If, on the other hand, you've had no sodium for weeks, a very salty popcorn for someone else will seem bland of salt to you. We know that the rat is an absolute pro at detecting what is missing in its diet. It can pick up a lack of one amino acid at 0.01% less. If you give it a diet that is adequate or one that is 0.01% deficient in lysine, he will go for the adequate diet without fail every time. We know that animals in the wild, for example, herbivores, learn very quickly which plants to avoid. I mean, within one afternoon, they got the whole meadow down pat as to what to eat and what not to eat. I believe that these things exist. They were indispensable to uneventful survival, to have these instincts and skills. But that in most of us, and to some extent our pets, the ability has faded.
Let's talk about, you. Before we went on the air, you gave this example of people love to see tigers in the zoo, but then they freak out when it's found out that they're being given horse meat.
It's a hugely emotional issue, this topic of animals and our love for them. And I've, for many years in the zoo work, been kind of a little bit frustrated and even angry about the fact that the zoo professional and the animal activist, at bottom, both want the very same thing. They want everybody happy. They want animals unabused. And they don't want them threatened in the wild. But they end up at polar opposites of the discussion, forgetting the huge area of common ground. And so you learn to live with this as part of your reality in my game. The zoo-going public wants the zoo to have tigers. But many of the zoo-going public doesn't want anything to die so that the tigers have something to eat.
Forgetting that the tiger is a feline and that the feline is a carnivore.
And that there's such a thing as a food chain.
Yeah.
Well, and no one fully appreciates the complicated mission of zoos. I mean, they're almost in each other's way. There's conservation, there's education, and there's entertainment. And everybody likes to go to the zoo and have entertainment. But at the rate that the human population increases and habitat shrinks, the future for some of these large animals is only in zoos. And so zoos have to learn how to maintain them in captivity if we're going to see them at all. And so they have to constantly balance between the people that want no caged animals ever again and the fact that there's no hope for some species unless we learn how to raise them in captivity.
I was thinking about this lately in regard to the tiger attack. I don't remember the zoo. I'm sure you do. Within the last couple of weeks.
That's right.
With the teenagers. And I was looking at Gulliver, my big orange cat, the other day, and, you know, playing with him. And when he gets overstimulated or when he gets cross, he'll pop out his little 5 switchblades and give me a couple of whacks. And that's what they do. That's if we go back to behavior, that's what a cat does. I mean, it gets irked and things happen. And when the cat is not 16.1 pounds, but instead several hundred, then it's a totally different situation. And it's fascinating to me that we, as a zoo-going public or as an animal interacting with public, look at it only from, seem to often only look at it from that anthropocentric perspective, where we forget that this is in fact an animal who has been around for many, many, many thousands of years and has its own way of doing things, and protecting them in captivity is not just about protecting dumb teenage kids from getting hurt, but also finding a way to keep this animal who, as you say, whose land we've encroached on, and et cetera, where it's not likely to be able to survive in the numbers it once did. The zoo becomes maybe more entertainment in the eye of the public than it does a way to protect the last few members of a species that because of our actions, are not as able to exist in the world anymore.
Anybody, to pick up on this thought, anybody that would go to the shelter, they'd be entertained by all the kittens and the puppies.
A lot of people come to the shelter just to see them, not to adopt, but just to see them. You're exactly right.
But meanwhile, there is this absolutely indispensable, critical mission of the shelter, above and beyond providing entertainment.
And on that note, it's actually time for us to go.
We were just getting going, Mary Charlotte.
I know. We'll have to do it again sometime, because there's a lot more that we have to learn about animal nutrition. But if people want to learn more, they can actually do so tonight, because Richard Patton, who's been joining us, is going to be lecturing at 6 o'clock at 2570 Camino Entrada in Santa Fe. That's kind of across from the auto park, and it's between the Outback Steakhouse and Kohl's department store.
And you animal havers, I would really encourage you to come. I have been entranced by the conversation we had before and during. And like they say, nothing's interesting until you get interested. And those of you with animals will definitely be interested.
Bill Hutchison is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. He joins us the first Wednesday, usually today's the second, but usually the first Wednesday of every month, to talk about animals. And we will be here again the first Wednesday of February. And Dr. Richard Patton, we want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Stuart Ashman. He is New Mexico's Cultural Affairs Secretary, and we're here to talk about the upcoming Culture Day. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, I thought Culture Day happened 365 days a year cultural mecca like Santa Fe.
It absolutely does. Although Culture Day is the day that we showcase what it is that we do all year. And it's an opportunity for the public to see what we do, and also for the state legislators, because we're in there trying to get funding in our annual budget.
Now, Culture Day is the 22nd of January.
That's right.
Which is a Tuesday, I think.
It's a Tuesday, yes.
And there's going to be things happening, Mozart and dancing and all sorts of other things. How did you put together the program? What's on it?
Well, we have, quite a staff in the Department of Cultural Affairs that's very committed to this program. And so what we do is everybody gets a kind of a quasi-booth. And they put together displays of their division, museum, monuments, archaeology, historic preservation, the state library, the arts agency. And they have representatives there, often giving out candy or something exciting like that.
To lure the children.
That's right, and the adults, and showcase what it is that they do all year. Of course, as you know, the Department of Cultural Affairs has 8 museums, 8 state monuments, the State Library, the State Historic Preservation Division. We have 55 archaeologists on staff. We have the Arts Agency, which gives out $900,000 a year to arts nonprofits around the state.
So that's a great deal of activity. How much of it is localized in Santa Fe?
Well, in Santa Fe, we have 4 museums, but the rest of, and the State Library and the State Arts Agency. But all of those serve statewide. And, of course, we have 2 museums in Albuquerque, 1 in Alamogordo, and 1 in Las Cruces. And then the monuments are scattered throughout the state.
So when we talk about New Mexico culture, there's, of course, our history, and then there's what's happening now. How are those two meeting? I mean, it seems like with all the great changes in the demographics of New Mexico, there are huge cultural changes that come with it.
That's true, and the department really is the cultural steward. We oversee culture in New Mexico, historic.
You are the cultural steward.
That's right. That's right. And every time somebody says cultural stewardship, I jump, you know. So the word is custom made to my name. But, you know, we're concerned with the historic legacy, the heritage, but also culture as it develops and the presentation of all of it. Because, as you know, it enriches the quality of life of everyone, citizens and visitors. And also, it's a huge economic engine for the state.
How does that actually work, this economic engine piece of it?
Well, we did a study a couple of years ago called Unfertile Ground, just to analyze how it was that the industry impacts the economy. And we discovered that there are 43,000 people in New Mexico working in arts-related professions. That's not just people obviously employed by the state, but that's, you know, in the 200-plus galleries in Santa Fe, in nonprofits around the state, etc. The economic impact of that is about $2.5 billion. And that, of course, in economics, you talk about multipliers. And that's, for example, if you're a painter and I buy your painting, that money counts towards the $2.5 billion. But the multiplier is when you take that money and you go buy a pair of shoes, because then that money keeps circulating in the economy. And if you count that money, it's just under $5 billion, which is huge to the economy in New Mexico.
What are, I mean, sometimes when... likes to think about the wonderful economic impact of our cultural, you know, you use the word industry, there are other times where it's, you know, it is our cultural life that gives us refuge and respite from the difficulty of making a living and of the economic life that we're constantly forced to be engaged in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's important to take time to contemplate the arts, to take time to see it not just as entertainment, but as something enriching. You know, it's unfortunate because even people in the profession, I remember when I was director of the art museum, I was so mired in the administrative duties that if I got a phone call from an artist that said, you know, I want you to come to my studio and take a look at my art, I'd say, think to myself, are you crazy? I don't have time to go look at art. And of course,
and you're a museum director.
Right. Of course, you have to make time to do that.
Right.
I think it's very important that we take time to do things like that with families. And the museums are really geared towards accepting visits from families so that, you know, there can be interaction between parents and children and relatives about the arts. And it all stimulates intellectual discussion. You know, why is this work of art hanging in a museum? You know, what is it that makes it special? Is it just a beautiful painting, or does it stimulate some kind of thought?
How do you think our young people are doing who are coming up through the school system in terms of being, I mean, you come from Cuba, you come from a country where dancing is something you learn, but around the same time you learn to walk, and everybody is naturally musical, and our country doesn't have those traditions ingrained in us. How do you think young people are doing right now in terms of having a sense of cultural participation and belonging?
Well, it's true that it's unfortunate that we don't pay enough attention to the arts. You know, arts and music and phys ed are the first thing to drop out when there are budget cuts in the education system. Fortunately, the Richardson administration has been very generous to the art community in that way. 2 years ago, putting $9 million into the school system for arts education. And some schools ended up with a music teacher or a part-time art teacher. But really, incorporating the arts into the curriculum is very important, because really you can learn a lot by looking at the art of a culture. You know, if you want to look at the art of Egypt, for example, as a way of studying that civilization, that would be a great way, a very accessible way for students to look at that culture. It's different than opening up a textbook and reading this happened on this year and this happened on that year. You know, it gives it an entry. In addition, analyzing the arts and the importance of the arts and how they impact communities creates a new way of thinking. You know, so somebody who is actually applied himself or herself to the arts may do better in a math SAT than somebody who just studied math. And I don't really know how that happens. You know, that's probably...
What? You're not a neuroscientist?
That's right. Yeah, that's left brain, right brain kind of stuff, which is way over my head. But I think that's very important. And, of course, there are people that are out there proving these elements, and that supports us. You know, it isn't entirely credible to the whole community, but I think people that look at education, certainly Veronica Garcia, our Secretary of Education, really understands that. There are many state representatives that understand the value of the arts. I know one senator in Las Cruces who actually homeschools four children, and part of his homeschool regimen is to go to museums, and that's pretty amazing. That's Rawlings, Senator Rawlings.
We're talking to Stuart Ashman, who is the Cultural Affairs Secretary of the State of New Mexico, and Culture Day is Tuesday, the 22nd of January. And where is all this stuff taking place?
This is, but let me make a correction. It's Senator Leonard Lee Rawson. But anyway, that all's taking place at the State Capitol Rotunda.
So right inside the roundhouse.
That's right, and it's right there on the main floor. It's open to the public. Parking is not the easiest thing during the legislative session, but it's worth coming down there. You know.
What are you hoping to achieve during the legislative session?
Well, you know, we're pretty fortunate in that we have support both from the executive side and the legislative side. So basically what we have to do is reconcile the differences in their recommendations. You know, the way the budget process works, the executive makes a recommendation and the legislature makes a recommendation. And as an executive agency, we support the executive recommendation, and then that's what we have to sell to the legislature. This year, there's a very small difference between the two, so I think we're going to have a pretty easy time. We have a budget that has grown under the Richardson administration from $34 million to $46 million. So that's almost a 25% increase over 5 years.
What are some of the projects you're really hoping to get going in the coming years?
Well, you know, in addition to our one of our big projects is a thing called MISP, MUSE, Media Industry Strategic Project for Museums. And what it is basically is teaching students at Highland University how to use computer technology for museum exhibits, for museum administration, for management of collections, things like that. And that's a growing program. We now have it. They have an exhibit at the Santa Fe Institute. And so it's really becoming embraced. And Mimi Roberts is in charge of that, and she's really gone, hit the ground running with this project. We have a lot of capital projects. We're trying to finish the New Mexico History Museum downtown. It's a 96,000 square foot facility. It's going to be finished this summer, and it'll be open in May of 2009. And really, it's going to be probably the biggest thing that's going to happen in this decade in the arts in New Mexico, in the arts and culture in New Mexico.
Well, we look forward to having an update from you perhaps after the session and talking more about the cultural life of this state.
It'll be my pleasure.
Stuart Ashman is the Cultural Affairs Secretary for the State of New Mexico. And once again, Culture Day is Tuesday, the 22nd of January in the Rotunda, right at the Roundhouse. We're going to take another little break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome Gabriel Gomez. He is not only the residency director at the Santa Fe Art Institute, but he's a writer and a poet, and his new book is coming out, a book of poetry, and he's going to have a reading this coming weekend. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
It's great to have you. Now, you have all sorts of secret lives that we've never seen. You make this wonderful thing happen, which is these residencies at the Santa Fe Art Institute, but you've been writing poetry all your life?
Pretty much. This is a book that The Outer Bands, it's my first collection. I think it took me about 6-7 years to put together from cover to cover, and it was actually already released in October, and so I've been kind of waiting to actually release it. So going to have the release party this Saturday at
El Farol. Yeah. So there's going to be poetry reading from 8 to 9:30, and then music after that.
Yeah, it's actually just a signing.
Oh, you're not going to be reading?
No, it's just I'm just
Gabriel. Gonna
I'm just going to sign, and depending on the how many drinks I have, and then maybe there might be spontaneous. but no, seriously, it's just a signing at 8, and just a killer band from El Paso. named Radio La Chusma will be doing the music at 9:30. And, yeah, it's going to be a great time.
So would you like to read a poem or two?
Sure. I'll probably just a couple of short ones that ran in here. Thanks, by the way, for having such short notice.
Oh, it's great. The book is called The Outer Bands.
Yeah. Let me read you Cupola, which is the first poem. I'm telling you a story of brick and bone, of merciless rain subduing cars in their tracks. I'm handling their images in my hand, a series of retablos, haloed faces and vapored windows. There's a picture of us sleeping, dreaming through an entire evening like nomads, twisted in the unembarrassed lightness of our flesh at rest, our mouths agape in frozen postulate, our arms and legs uprooted. This furious architecture of the severed connection has forgotten the origin of you and I. Buildings rise out of our arrested flesh, veins stunning along our arms, forgotten in our ambivalent embrace between now and nowhere.
Gabriel Gomez, it's interesting because you sent me a copy of that poem, but it sounds really different reading it, than it aloud than it was reading it on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's always, it's funny because what I hear in my head and what other people, like, obviously they're hearing their own head, and then when I read it, it's always a different experience sort of reading it out loud.
When you write, do you write with the... do you write hearing it?
I think so. It's my love of sort of word and language began with I'm bilingual, Spanish and English, so the sort of music, the inherent music in the language. So it's always start with, it begins with the words, you know, and it just takes it from there. And so it's not so much an idea or a subject, but the actual language itself, you know, the sort of the, like I said, the inherent music in the words and the, you know, the.
Do you write in Spanish?
Not really.
Why not?
my Spanish is a little rusty. I speak it fluently, but writing's a different animal.
What's your heritage?
My folks are from Chihuahua, from Mexico. And so I'm first generation. So I grew up in El Paso, Texas, and just kind of came north from there. So
how did you start writing poetry?
Through music, actually. And I used to replace the lyrics to, like, Dylan in R.E.M. You know, really, I mean, that's how I learned about rhythms and...
So you'd keep the tunes and put new lyrics?
I'd keep the tunes and I put the lyrics in, and that's how I kind of learned about the structure and... But, you know, my folks love to play music in the house, and I've always been had a real sort of emotional attachment to it, you know, and so I love, you know, digging through music and obviously now the column. But it really started through that, through looking, you know, listening to the stories that were told through the lyrics and stuff, so.
And you also write a music column.
Yeah, Ruckus.
For The Reporter.
For The Reporter, yeah. And I've been doing that a little over a year, and it's been terrific, and meeting tons of really great artists around town, and it's been a lot of fun. It's always a challenge to do it weekly, but it's been terrific.
Would you like to read another poem?
Sure. Actually, do you have a copy of that? This is from, Chorus. I'll read that. This is from a new collection that I just completed. It's from a book called Breach.
Which is a new book?
It's a new manuscript that I just finished.
So you spent 6 years putting together your first one
in about nine months.
2 months putting together your second?
No, I started this one in, I guess it's 2006, and I think the bones were fleshed out in about 9 months. And I showed it to a few people and a publisher and said, you know, why don't you just hang out with it just a little bit? And so this is the first poem from that collection. So hopefully it'll see the light of day in the next year or two. And it's called Chorus. Of the old myths printed on vellum and water, all fall opaque, white as mouths, chewing and peeking on the waves of open watts as they spill from the satellites. You've only begun to believe the warmth escaping from the earth at sunset, chasing the noon of sunlight into darkness, and the day it leaves remarkably tuned. On this table, my friend laments the resting body of a girl her father sculpted from stone, her legs snapped at mid-thigh, broken neatly on a hairline seam buried in the crisp obsidian. From it, another face rises to her surface as my friend speaks over the segments of the body back into one. Three languages resisting the silence of unison, of body, of spirit, of the voice spelling it out. The sculpted girl had once stared into the heaps of our world until she had fallen from her abrupt edge into a new art, limbs of new light, twisting from her womb towards it.
Gabriel Gomez, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
And Gabriel's new book of poetry is called The Outer Bands, and he will be doing a book signing on Saturday, this Saturday, the 12th of January, at 8 o'clock at El Farol Restaurant in Santa Fe, right toward the end of Canyon Road. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the outstanding jazz CDs of 2007, and Giants of Jazz features Wynton Marsalis. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.